Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for January 8th, 2023. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks. And this is Wrestling Night in America, where we talk to big shows in pro wrestling. And we want to do it with you, the listeners. So if you're listening live, you can hit us up with a phone call. 515-605-9345 is the number to call. Press 1 to show up in the queue that you'd like to talk. Otherwise, if you're a little shy, or perhaps you're not listening live, you're listening later in the week and want to get a question in for next week's show, you can do that via email, wnialivecast@gmail.com. So we're going to talk about New Japan's Wrestle Kingdom Night 1 tonight. We're going to preview Impact's Hard to Kill pay-per-view, which they have coming up Friday from Center Stage in Atlanta, Georgia. We'll talk about the results of that next week. So if you're an Impact Wrestling fan, you're certainly going to want to tune in. I know we don't do a lot of coverage of the weekly show here on Wrestling Night in America, but we do like to talk about the pay-per-views and the special events that they have. And to help me break down the New Japan show, I welcome PWTorch.com contributor Javier Machado with me here today. Javier, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Greg, how's it going? Always great to join you on one of these things.
Absolutely. Always glad to have you and your New Japan expertise. I know that you've already actually done a review of this show in some ways in audio form for PWTorch.com, so I'll try to throw in some curveball questions or some things that maybe you didn't get a chance to talk about on that review pod earlier in the week.
I held stuff back specifically for you.
Oh, that's sweet. That's wonderful. I love that. True care for our listeners here on Wrestling Night in America. But first, Javier, we got to talk about the elephant in the room, and that is the return of Vince McMahon.
Do we really?
Well, I feel like we do. We like to focus not so much on the news here of the week, but on the big shows. But this one, I think, is too big to kind of let go. And I want to start off with an email question we got. And this is from B from Pennsylvania. And he or she writes, "Hi, Greg. With the recent Vince news, do you think this was premeditated and always Vince's intention to return to the company in some form? Do you think it's a possibility that Vince told Triple H, Stephanie, and Nick Khan when he resigned that he had every intention of returning to the company after his investigation blew over?" That's an interesting view of things. I'm not sure. It's entirely possible. With Vince being literal family with Stephanie and Triple H, I'm sure the subject has come up more than once. So it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. What's your take on that potentiality and just the situation as it stands as a whole?
I doubt it. I think at the moment that he resigned, I think was because they even mentioned it the first time they floated the rumor of him coming back that he had received bad advice. I think he found himself besieged on all sides. If you look at the stuff that had happened previous to that, he became isolated. Michelle Barrios and Michelle and George Barrios.
Michelle Wilson.
Yeah, they had they were gone, and it felt like he was isolated. You have all this stuff coming at him at once. I think, he said, okay, you know what, I don't really want to deal with this at this point, and then stepped aside. Once he had chance to say, hey, I got, I'm not saying that he did. I'm saying from his point of view, likely, it's, hey, I got railroaded here, and he's using his power basically to get back. And if you notice at the speed that things are working at, from the moment that he said that, this might be happening, and then the next day it happened. Barrios and Wilson are back, it speaks to me that he's trying to get a foothold in. So if the forces are reined against him, when they make their next move, he's dug in as a tick, and I'm pretty sure that he's the type of person who, if they're going to take me down, I'm going to take the company down with me.
What's the motivation here? Is it simply ego? Is it boredom? Is it, you know, because it would be one thing if WWE stock tanked, if ratings were in the toilet, if the product had been poorly received and people were begging for Vince to come back, but that's simply not the case. Vince could have sat back. He could have allowed Nick Khan to help negotiate the next television deal, which, you know, part of the reason he was hired was because of his ability to negotiate these kind of deals, Nick Khan, that is. And so he should have the utmost confidence in Nick Khan to be able to do that. And so he's couching this in the fact that, you know, I feel like I'm the best person to be able to do this. And again, that would ring more true if the people in place in leadership maybe weren't capable of doing that or weren't doing the job as it stands. But the ship has been righted. You know, there's no reason for Vince to kind of take the controls again. So what was the real motivation here, do you think?
It's mostly going to be ego and in respect to this, for sure. You know, it's if you think about, like, tyrants in the past, nothing's worth, you know, you want to feel like you're the most important bit in the machine, and if you leave and all of a sudden things stay the same or get better, that it's not going to leave you with a good feeling.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned this earlier. You don't believe, I assume, that Vince comes back, he negotiates the next TV deal, he negotiates maybe the sale of the company, and then he just kind of washes his hands and said, well, I've done all I can do, I'm just going to step aside now. Is there any chance that happens?
No chance in hell, Greg. No chance in hell.
I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know how much of it's going to be – I mean, I don't know how much of it's going to be up to the new ownership either. Like, is he going to steer the sale of the company to a group that is sympathetic to putting him in, or giving him some power within the company? I mean, that's going to be the really interesting thing there too.
Yeah, my guess is that that's exactly what he'll try to do. Well, there are only two options, pretty much. Either he's going to go with someone who's going to give them less money and, you know, and leave him with more power, or the only way that he would be fine leaving it if they give him, like, twice, you know, like, you know, a huge percentage above what it's worth. So those are pretty much the two options. You're not going to get, like, a good deal. You're going to either get, like, a stupid amount of money, which right now, I mean, the problem is that in the streaming wars right now, we're seeing cutbacks. We're not seeing money being spent. You're seeing what's going on with HBO Max, and I believe Amazon just let go a bunch of people. Netflix has issues. They scaled back on, like, their animation departments and other stuff. So right now there's a contraction going on. HBO Max is just, like, ahead of the curve, and you're starting to see others start doing that. Disney, I'm sure Disney at some point is not going to be able to keep with the same production of the schedule they have with all the Star Wars and Marvel stuff that's going straight to streaming service and their whole Disney Plus stuff, because, you know, they're being buoyed by, you know, the money they make in other places like parks and stuff. So, but, you know, I don't think that in the street, you know, like if they were to go to Amazon, for example, I don't think they would be able to give them the amount of money that they would have, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago. Same thing Disney, if they go in that direction, or Netflix, or any one of these streaming giants, which is the most likely chance. Also, there's the Saudi government, who wants to continue divesting themselves from oil and buying into stuff, and they've been interested in WWE. And I would think that if they sell to the Saudis, they would be more likely to keep McMahon on board. You know, there's just some examples of pretty much how, you know, the way that things are going to likely go.
It sort of reminds me of when Vince declared bankruptcy of the XFL in 2020, and they went into bankruptcy, and, you know, they were looking for potential buyers. And despite saying he wasn't planning on it, Vince actually, like, wanted to buy it back out of bankruptcy. Like, so even something like the XFL, where he kind of he puts in a bankruptcy, and it's kind of a free for all to see who the top buyer is. And he was going to try and swoop and buy it back, you know, until the creditors made a fuss about that, and he had to kind of back away. But even something like that, you know, he can't divest himself from very easily. So the idea, I guess, looking back, that he could just simply walk away from WWE, which every aspect of WWE, the things that you see, the things that you don't see, have had his fingerprints on it for the last several decades. And I guess the idea that he could just step away from it cold turkey, you know, that was kind of foolhardy of us to think. And I know that a lot of people didn't believe that. And I know a lot of people who thought that he would come back or try to come back in some way, exactly how he has this week. So that's going to be a major story in 2023. Absolutely is. So I wanted to kind of get that out of the way early. That way we could move on to New Japan. We could move on to some other things that we'll talk about tonight, Javier, with you. Again, 515-605-9345 is the number to call. And you can email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. So Wrestle Kingdom, night one. Javier, just kind of overall thoughts on the show and the direction that New Japan presented heading into the new year.
Okay, I'm going to call it a pay-per-view. I know it's not a pay-per-view per se, but I'm going to call it a pay-per-view. So just to have a common language. As far as pay-per-views are concerned, it was a good pay-per-view. As far as Wrestle Kingdom being equivalent to like WrestleMania, I thought it was okay. That's pretty much my feel towards it. It was really a story of essentially like two matches. Rest of the stuff was cool. Also, a little bit melancholy because it was the first Wrestle Kingdom without Inoki, and that was a presence throughout the show. You also had Kijimuto's retirement match. So it kind of took an air of end of an era, particularly since like Tanahashi, I think it was the first time in a long time he wasn't in a singles match on the show. So that's like kind of – it had a feel of like an end of an era. Plus, they also gave, but on the plus side, they also gave some shine to some of the returning young lions who are now returning, from excursion. Ren Narita facing off against Zack Sabre Jr. and Shooter Umino, getting a spotlight. So it feels like a sort of changing of the guard, not completely, but it kind of makes me feel like this is what this year. From now to the next Wrestle Kingdom, maybe a little bit beyond what the it's going to be about the changing of the guard in New Japan.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the way you said it as a two-match show, I totally agree with that. That's not to say there weren't good matches up and down the card, but it definitely felt like there were two absolutely big matches that completely separated themselves from the rest of the card. And so that's not, I know it kind of sounds like a backhanded compliment, but I don't mean it that way. The two matches were very early match of the year candidates. I just filled out my Voices of Wrestling top 10 ballot and sent that in today. And I'm keeping track on my phone and my notes app of, the matches that I think might be in the conversation at the end of the year when I'm filling out my ballot. And I've already put Omega versus Ospreay and Okada versus Jay White on there. So, when we say it's a two-match show or a show built around only two of, say, nine main show matches, that's not necessarily a dig when those two matches are match of the year candidates. But we'll start at the top and talk about the IWGP Junior Tag Titles. TJP and Akira defeated Leo Rush and Yo to win that one. High-flying match here, fast-paced. TJP looks quite different than I saw him last. I think it's the haircut, I'm not sure. But they retain over Leo Rush and Yo. Do you see these teams sticking around together through the duration of 2023? I know Leo Rush is kind of in an odd position. TJP's over there in Japan. I don't know if he's making that his home base now, but what do you see on the horizon for these two teams in 2023?
Well, dipping into New Year's Dash, which was on the following day, and we already have answers to some of this. Leo Rush was injured during the match. He blocked the grating with his face, and it did not go well for his face. It led to a bloody mass on half of his face, which cut for an amazing image. I've been mentioning this a lot. It was, you know, just half his face was completely bloody. The other half was mostly clean. And there's one moment in the match where the camera catches him profile on the clean side. And then he turns the camera and then it looks like a, you know, horror show on the other side. So that, you know, that added a level of visceralness to the match, which I thought was really good. And, you know, this, you know, they liked starting shows, the show proper. There were two or three previous matches to this, but the show proper with, you know, the flippy stuff to get people excited over stuff. TJP, yeah, I'm not feeling the haircut. It looks like TJP and Francisco Akira are going to be facing. One second, let me check my notes because I wrote the notes, but my notes are like, I did a horrible job writing this. but Yo looks like Yo's challenging Hiromu for the IWP Junior Heavyweight Championship. He was the one who got the win in New Year's Dash on their in that tag team match, and it was a very, very convincing win. I mean, you know, basically Yo was in the ring with Hiromu for the last little bit of the match after getting triple teamed, and then he basically made a comeback on Hiromu and beat him, just beat him in quick fashion, which I think Yo needs in order to make him a serious contender for Hiromu. So that looks like that's what's next for them. They did set up with something with TJP and Akira. Yeah, Doki and Kanemaru, I believe. One of them got the victory, but I'm not sure who got the victory in that. But Doki and Kanemaru versus TJP and Akira looks like is going to be the next challengers for the junior heavyweight tag team titles. Doki and Kanemaru joined with Takamichi Noku and Taichi to form a team called Just Four Guys. Kind of has a feeling of a comedy group. Particularly that name, with Taka kind of being over the top and, you know, Doki and Kanemaru being involved, which kind of makes me feel bad because I really like Taichi and I was hoping that I wasn't expecting him to be the top main eventer, but someone who, you know, would occasionally, you know, headline like a C-level pay-per-view, C-level show, you know, one of the smaller tours to get, you know, a little bite at the apple, but it looks like Taichi is not, there, although him and Ospreay got into it, so that looks like what's up next for Taichi is Will Ospreay.
Just Four Guys sounds like a band that played down the street at the local bar on Saturday night, but
yeah.
You know,
I'm
glad you. Yes, of course. I'm glad you mentioned the blood because the follow up to that, Leo Rush suffered a broken nose, apparently. So, but it was. And I'm not saying, yeah, go out there and bleed hard way because it's different and it's fun. But it did give something different on a New Japan show because it's very unusual, I think, to see that level of blood on a New Japan show. I mean, it's not like Jon Moxley on AEW where, you know, every week you can kind of set your watch to it. So it did provide something different and something memorable for that match, even if it was to the detriment of Leo Rush's immediate future.
Yeah, I heard he got taken out of the PWG show he was supposed to attend.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. So hopefully he gets better and gets back on his feet soon and back in the ring. Match number two was Kairi defeating Tam Nakano to retain the IWGP Women's title. This was cool because, you know, I wish I had time to get into Stardom because I think it's really a promotion that I would enjoy. But there's still only 24 hours in the day, last time I checked, so it's very difficult. But to see Kairi in this environment having a match at a speed twice the speed that she did in WWE, you know, it was really fascinating to watch here. And, of course, the big talking point coming out of this was the debut of the former Sasha Banks, Mercedes Moné, who came out and staked her claim for the IWGP Women's title. So, I guess we'll split this up into two, the match and then the aftermath. Kyrie and Nakano, this was a match that, you know, if you had not known, it did not feel out of place. It took a little getting used to, and I think even the live crowd, New Japan's live crowds have not gotten used to women's matches, I don't think, and it's kind of funny to say that in a unfortunate way. They just haven't gotten used to how to react, or maybe they're not as familiar with the characters. But it fit on the show in terms of match quality.
Yeah, my understanding is that there has been a pushback with the inclusion of the women in the New Japan shows. Most of the loudest cheering you could tell was coming from people who came from outside to actually watch the to be part of Wrestle Kingdom. I could probably talk about like an hour on this match. The thing that they're trying to do is basically, with the introduction of the IWGP title, it's a way for when they tour in the U.S., they have women's matches in there. Because here in the U.S., we expect to have women's matches on a card. So by introducing the IWGP title, that's kind of like, you know, that's kind of what that's there for. And to give it some shine, they are putting it on a New Japan show, on the bigger New Japan shows. Originally, they had them in some of the pre-shows. Now this is actually on the card. It's the idea, but here's the thing. So I understand that there might not be an appetite for that in Japan, but the idea of presenting this on the show like this and having the title is in order to serve the two masters, get people more interested in Stardom, Bushiroad, who owns New Japan, bought Stardom, get more interested, hopefully get more subscriptions, which is, why they brought, they reportedly backed up a Brinks truck for Sasha Banks to get her in, to draw attention to the women's, the way that Sasha Banks, Mercedes put it, I'm not sure if they're actually talking about an actual, like, New Japan actual women's division or meant to be Stardom. Her, promo was kind of weird on that. She, bringing her in was to create more buzz mainly for, when they tour here and to get some more subscriptions to Stardom. However, this was the first big disappointment of the night for me because I tuned in hoping for them to sell me on a Stardom subscription. Sell me on Stardom, start watching it, to start following, so I could buy a pay-per-view. And the match went for over 5 minutes. You mentioned that they were, moving faster than Kyrie did. It felt because this was like a 10 to 15 minute match and they had to get all their stuff in 5 minutes. So it was just basically bam, 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 move from spot to spot. This felt barely more than an exhibition than an actual championship match, which I think shortchanged the people who were actually interested in the match. And I don't think it serves the purpose of, if your purpose is to get people to subscribe to Stardom, and if your purpose is to get people excited for when Kyrie comes to wrestling in the United States, I don't think you serve that purpose if you're only going to give them the amount of time that they got in this. So I thought that was a total misstep because you the fans who don't want to watch it on the show, you've upset them, and the people who do want to watch it are upset because these didn't get the full something to really sink your teeth into.
How necessary is it that New Japan even have women's wrestling in the shows in the United States? You say that they kind of feel like they have to because people expect it. Even though New Japan doesn't have a women's division, I know that they're borrowing from Stardom and everything like that, but is that something you sense is truly necessary for New Japan to break into America, either culturally or, even business-wise?
I think this is a question more about the people who are vocal, because like if you check on Twitter and some articles and stuff saying that, hey, where are the women, so I'm kind of more along the lines of Wade Keller, that if you've got something, if you have a way to, don't just throw them in there to placate and because that's not fair to anybody, and have the women involved in meaningful matches and stuff, which is what looks like they're trying to do by creating the IWGP women's title. And it looks like they're trying to give a reason for, make you know, it important to have these matches. Because, I mean, Kairi and Mercedes is going to be, you know, a great match, a co-main event. I believe the main event for the Battle in Valley is going to end up being Cobb and Kenny Omega, but we'll get to that later. But that's like a co-main event kind of spot to be put in, you know, so there are giving, you know, there are trying to make it more important than just, you know, just putting anybody in there. So I'll give them credit for that. Mm-hmm. But I think it is for the louder people who would decry, hey, this is, you know, unfair, and we, you know, we're in 2023, and, you know, equal, you know, I think that's kind of what they're trying to head any, you know, that kind of conversation by including them. I think that's patronizing in general to some extent. Rather personally, like if you're not going to put your effort into it, don't just throw them on there just to you know, shut some people up basically. And instead, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you have something to do, and to their credit, like I said, they have something, you know, it looks like they are putting their effort for when they do the U.S. shows and do the U.S. touring. But when it was in Japan, it didn't seem it was reflected like they were serious, and they were like, okay, we're just going to get this over with because we're going to promote, you know, elsewhere.
Well, let's talk about Mercedes Moné, because she was a big talking point coming out of this show, and if New Japan's goal was to get women, get people talking about the women, I think they succeeded here. Whether or not it was positive or negative talk, I think it was a mixed bag for me with Mercedes. She was absolutely treated like a star. I loved the video package that preceded her debut, where it kind of didn't show her face yet, and it kind of teased who it was going to be. I thought the outfit was a lot, but it was the makings of a star. I mean, she had that star quality with that outfit that she came out with. To me, everything that happened once she got in the ring was the negative. The finisher that she did was confusing. I didn't really know what was going on as I was watching it. It was quite the roller coaster ride for me as a viewer to watch that move, even though it lasted a second or two. And then the promo, I thought, was not good. The content, the delivery, I thought it just felt like way too much like she dropped a WWE promo in the middle of a New Japan show, and I'm not sure that is the right move for her. So tell me what you thought about the entire package of what you saw of the Mercedes Moné debut.
I'm just going to pretty much regurgitate everything you just said there. because in the build-up to this was, you know, not a secret that you know, she was, you know, all the stuff that she's in Japan, that she's going to be showing up in Wrestle Kingdom and all this stuff. We already knew this. This was one of the two missteps I felt from the commentary crew. Where near the end of the Kairi match, they mentioned, oh, you know, or I think it was after the Kairi match, lights went on. I think it was right before. Oh, you know, we need to touch up on the rumors about a big return. And then yeah. Gino is, you know, and then he goes, oh, that's because thank you, Kevin. Yeah, it's all about you. In kind of like a cutesy misdirection kind of thing while you're calling a championship match. Didn't like that at all in the slightest bit. I think it kind of like, turning on the comedy for what is going to be a big reveal-ish or, you know, big, you know, not really a surprise, but a big, you know, return or not return, but like debut. There we go. So I thought that it was so commentary didn't help that any matters. And for people just, you know, I'm not been a fan of Sasha Banks, the character of Sasha Banks. I was never a fan of the her presentation in that. I think she was a great wrestler. And I saw this when the rumors were that she was coming to New Japan, presumably Stardom, that this was a shot to see her without the WWE scripting, because I was willing to give her the benefit of the doubt that it was the scripting that was the issue where she couldn't get her character across. Correct. So when she then cut the promo, it wasn't the scripting. I don't know. Did it feel like to you that she was putting on like a weird accent?
I just think that her diction is just, she's very like she over enunciates sometimes, I think. So I'm not sure if it was an accent or if it was that or what it was.
Yeah, I mean, unless it's like her real way of speaking, but like there's something like when she would end phrases, it would sound weird. She did seem like she was cutting a WWE promo, like you said. I mean, maybe by being green, because there's some people who've come out of WWE and have heard them cut promos and they sound just the same. So I was already, that was already disappointing. The hair was super striking, but it was so busy that I was more concerned about what the hell was going on with her hair than what she was saying. So it was distracting to the package. When you see in the still shots, it looks great. But you know, when you're, you know, when she's talking and stuff, it was distracting trying to figure out what was going on there. And then, you know, that because that sense seemed like it was a botch. I think she was supposed to do some sort of move, and I think Kyrie thought something else was coming, and that looked like a mess. So that didn't help any. And you could see in the immediate reaction in Sasha Banks' face was like, you know, well, that didn't go. and, you know, so, so yeah. And then it doesn't help that, again, the people in you know, the crowd in Japan, the only ones who were really cheering for her, the ones who already are felt like it was the, you know, the people who were, you know, were tourists coming to visit, because, you know, the lack, you know, the, you know, they're not, a lot of people watch New Japan in Japan aren't necessarily people who watch WWE. So they're not aware of her in WWE, so they're like, you know, who is this? And then at the same time, you have, you know, and then like I said, some people who are just not, don't want the women involved in the New Japan. So you had what felt like a tepid response when it, if it would have happened like at Battle in the Valley, and that would have been her introduction, you would have had the crowd going nuts, and you probably would have had a better, you know, reaction when it came to that. So all that aside, I am looking forward to the actual wrestling, because I think she's a great in-ring talent, and seeing her without governors on is what I'm ultimately most interested in, her showing up to these events, assuming, of course, that they give them time. Because if this is all to build up for Kyrie, Mercedes, Monet in a, you know, 10-minute IWGP title match, you know, that's like the second, third match on the card, I'm not interested in that. I want it to either be your opener for some crazy stuff or your main event or semi-main event. You know, something, you know, important, because if you're just going to throw them out there, then, again, what's the point of this pomp and circumstance if ultimately you're not going to pay it off?
And given the price tag that Mercedes Moné likely comes with, you would imagine that New Japan would want to get enough bang for their buck and not just slough it off there as sort of a middle-of-the-show match and then, okay, this happened, let's move on type of deal. You would want to hype it up as something big and get as many eyeballs on it as possible. So I would expect that. And like you said, I would expect the match to be good. I would expect there to be a lot of intrigue in the buildup, people wanting to see this match. You know, Mercedes Moné has been training in different places. She stayed in the ring. So it'll be interesting to see what she's added to her arsenal in terms of moveset and work in the ring since we last saw her in WWE. Let's go over one more match, and then we'll go to the phones. Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland is waiting. Yeah, go ahead.
No, and just to mention two other things that I did not like about her presentation is the Moné name. It's obviously supposed to be a pun for, you know, show me the money and stuff like that. Immediately had me and my brother talking, thinking about History of the World Part One, you know, the Count de Monet character. So it felt too, you know, punerific for me. And also taking the whole, I'm the boss thing that she did, but now she's the CEO. I would probably divest myself a lot from what she did in WWE and come up with something that's not, doesn't feel like a blatant copy that I can't, you know, I have to switch it up a little bit because not, you know, I get sued kind of thing. I think it would have been better for her to develop something else. So those were two other, you know, missteps I thought.
I do like the name. I'll give her that. I'll disagree with you slightly there. I like the name. The CEO moniker is only worth it if Kevin Kelly shouts, "It's CEO time," like Michael Cole always used to shout, "It's boss time." So it's only worth it if we can get Kevin Kelly to do that. So somebody get on Twitter and holler at him for that. The third match on the show was Hirooki Goto and Yoshihashi defeating FTR to win the IWGP tag titles. FTR is – they're all belts must go. It's a clearance sale for FTR and all the titles they've held. They're losing them at a record pace. Certainly bringing up a lot of questions, especially once it was leaked or reported by someone that one of FTR's contracts, which you'd expect both of them, were expiring in April from AEW. There's suspicion that they might go back to WWE with Triple H now in charge of the booking. And obviously Triple H booked them very strongly when they were in NXT. There's also the possibility that they could just go the indie route and do – you know, select indie dates, wrestle whoever they want, whenever they want, even though this, you feel like that's basically what they've been doing anyway this past year. So how do you read the FTR title losses? Are we reading too much into it? Or, you know, what do you see on the horizon for them in 2023? Do they head back to WWE? Do they re-sign with AEW? Do they just kind of stick to an indie schedule?
Yeah, I mean, this sure feels like they're heading to WWE the way that they dropped, because, you know, remember, this is across multiple companies. So, you know, had it been just one company, then you could kind of tell you're telling a story. Maybe, you know, this sets up, since they're one run at the AEW title, you know, because that's the one they didn't win, and, you know, they need to get back on track and win it. But I find it hard to really necessarily buy that, considering the fact, again, these are multiple companies. The fact that they're New Japan champions wasn't really mentioned much on AEW TV after a certain point. So, yeah, it has the feel that's what they're going to do, or they're going to start working a reduced schedule, just sticking to the indies. I mean, that's essentially sticking to the indies, what they've been doing, because they were AAA and New Japan and, well, you know, RH is technically AEW champs. So that kind of feels like what they were doing anyway. But if they're planning on either going on a more reduced schedule or and not want to, you know, be involved in having to do, you know, being, you know, on call for Tony Khan and just, you know, work spot shows here and there, that's a possibility of that, or, you know, like I said, heading to WWE.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. I think they'll be in demand no matter what happens. And I wouldn't expect them to make a decision until maybe even perhaps the last moment. 515-605-9345 is the number to call. Greg Parks and Javier Machado here with you on Wrestling Night in America, talking New Japan Wrestle Kingdom Night 1. Well, let's go to the phones for our first call this evening. As usual, it is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, hit us with your first question for us tonight.
My first question is on the potential sale at WWE. Which buyer you think would try to put a world champion in that would be quite bizarre? Like, say, do you think Disney might try to put in like a Disney princess as their women's champion, or Saudi Arabia might try to put someone from that country as their world champion? Like, what do you think is more likely to happen?
You know, Saudi Arabia, when WWE first started doing shows there, there were reports that the king wanted, you know, Yokozuna and these wrestlers from decades ago, some of which are no longer with us in the mortal realm. So you could definitely see them, depending on who in Saudi Arabia, whether it's the actual government or, you know, private company in that country buys them. But hopefully, you know, there's always going to be synergy and the desire to have synergy, whether it's with a character or whatever the case may be. You know, we saw that back in the Turner days at WCW during that time. And even WWE, you see it with the Mountain Dew Pitch Black match that's coming up at the Royal Rumble pay-per-view. So you're always going to have, no matter who owns the company, that desire for synergy. The hope is, Javier, that whoever does buy the company knows enough about wrestling to keep their nose out of the booking decisions and the character creation decisions, and just watch their money roll in.
Yeah, that would be the hope. Any company that brings them in, you know, you're buying a product, and you know, because it's doing well, and let's not tinker with it because, you know, that's not why we bought the product. But that doesn't always happen. I think that I'd be loath to see Disney buy it right now. That would be one. Amazon maybe, because will be another one because, you know, I don't know, like, the people in charge, how much they're into wrestling. Like, I wouldn't want Saudi Arabia, you know, they're, you know, wrestling fans. And like you said, you know, bring back the people I remember kind of thing. Maybe go back to, you know, storylines I remember and, you know, that don't work now. That's always a concern. You would hope, though, that that you know, better heads would prevail and they just would leave it alone. One of the rumored would be one of the ones I read somewhere rumored was The Rock with an investment group coming in and purchasing it, which would be, you know, he knows wrestling and he hopefully he would, you know not to mess with stuff.
Yeah, I mean, The Rock is already working with Redbird Capital on the XFL, so who knows? Maybe they get
that
feeling like
that,
it.
That was the
I mean, hard to rule it out, but it's going to be interesting. Like I said, it's going to be an interesting year to see how this develops and the twists and turns that we'll experience, no doubt, throughout the process. Ryan, back to you for your second question.
My second question is on Montez Ford's behavior on Raw. It looked like he was doing some like heel mannerisms. Do you think if he was to turn heel that Bianca Belair would turn heel as well also? Because I think Becky Lynch is beginning more cheers based on the house show I went to a couple weeks ago in Hershey. So I wonder if we'll see a double turn there between those two.
I mean, I have a hard time seeing Bianca turning heel. You know, Becky obviously is a baby face right now, and Bianca is a baby face and seems to be working just fine. I don't think, you know, it's a bad thing. And I actually, you know, I had a problem with this in NXT when they turned Cora Jade. You know, it's not wrong. It's not against the rules to have two strong baby face characters. And so, you know, I think that was my frustration at the time was NXT had Cora Jade. They saw had Roxanne Perez as their baby face star that they wanted to push. And so they turned Cora Jade heel. And it just felt like they did that because they didn't want two strong baby faces for whatever reason. So you can do that. You can keep them separate. You can even have them wrestle as two baby faces at some point. But I wouldn't read too much into the deal with Montez Ford having any effect, Javier, on Bianca Belair. I think that would be a mistake at this point.
No, Montez Ford's reaction, I think, was due to if I'm not, you know, staying overnight watching New Japan has completely screwed up my my recollection of anything that happened last week. So I may be wrong on this. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I think his reaction was mainly due to the fact of what had happened to his wife earlier on in the show, that he was out of it and that, you know, and couldn't, you know, had no time to deal with the stuff that was going on. In respect to what's going on with women, I'm pretty sure that you have to worry about Becky Lynch because most likely she's going to be dealing with Charlotte Flair would be my guess. How they get there, I have no idea. And then because I think Bianca and Rhea Ripley are the more likely suspects unless they're planning on doing Beth Phoenix and Rhea Ripley at WrestleMania.
All right, Ryan, your third and final question for us tonight.
My final question is on Sasha Banks. If you were to do a match, do you think it'll remain like in the under 6 minute mark like the January 4th women's match was, or you think she'll get a 30 minute match like Kenny Omega is getting or Okada is getting?
Well, I think part of it, and Javier spoke to this, is where they do it. You know, if it's in the United States where fans are familiar enough with her and, you know, fans have been conditioned now to appreciate women's wrestling and what it brings to the table, then, you know, maybe 30 minutes is pushing it, just considering she hasn't been in the ring in a while at wrestling. But I think you would see, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. But, you know, they're conditioning the New Japan fans is, again, as Javier mentioned, a work in progress. So I don't think you would see them jump right out, Javier, to having Mercedes Moné or anyone wrestle 30-minute matches in front of a crowd that really doesn't know these wrestlers or doesn't understand why they are watching women wrestle these days, you know, or anything like that. So you know, again, it's in America probably. In Japan, I think it's going to be a learning process, a re-education process of the fans to buy into women's wrestling and what they're seeing.
Yeah, they can process it in one or two different ways. If it's an opener, just like a quick 15-minute, hard-hitting, get the crowd awake kind of match. If it's a semi-main event, I mean, it could be a main event. It's just that I think the main event is going to be Kenny Omega and Jeff Cobb. So, you know, that I think that'll likely trump it. But if it's a semi-main event, you could probably give them 25 minutes, which is what I'm hoping for. That's what I'm hoping for, that you have the ability for them to tell the story in the match. And then here in the U.S., people are going to buy it because that is the purpose. People know Kairi Sane because of her stint in WWE, and Sasha Banks, she was a star, one of the top women stars in the U.S. So I think that is the plan, is to actually give them some trust. How much trust? I do not know how far they're going to go. We'll see when the match, I believe, has already been officially set for Battle in the Valley. I may be wrong on that. But Battle in the Valley is going to be the when they're going to face off. So that's going to be here, and hopefully, like I said, 25-minute match, with all the bells and whistles, probably be around 30 minutes and stuff.
All right, Ryan, thanks for the phone call tonight.
Thanks for answering the questions and taking the call. Thank you.
Absolutely. Always look forward to Ryan calling in each week. Going back to the Wrestle Kingdom show, Javier, match number four was Zack Sabre Jr. defeating Ren Narita for the New Japan television title. This is a tournament final for this. And then Sabre joins TMDK after the match, the Mighty Don't Kneel. Interesting development there. I know they teamed up together on the next night's show, New Year's Dash. So talk a little bit about what you thought of the match. I thought it was a good match. I'm a huge Zack Sabre Jr. fan. It was good to see Ren Narita. As you talked about earlier, him and Shota Umino, former Young Boys, sort of getting their first characters, getting their first extended shot in the deep end of the pool, I'll say. But what did you make of the match and then the follow-up of Sabre joining Mikey Nichols and Shane Haste there?
Well, first let me ask you a question, Greg, because I don't think anyone bit when I offered this a few times. Is it just me, or was Ren Narita trying to ape Katsuyori Shibata way too much? Because this almost felt like he was essentially like a mini-me clone of Shibata.
Yeah, I could definitely see how you could get that. It didn't jump out to me enough to where it like stuck in my brain as I was watching it. But certainly thinking back on it, I could see how you could see that as you were watching the match, especially if you've watched a lot of Shibata. I confess that, I've watched enough New Japan to, know who he is and be familiar with his background and see a good chunk of his matches, but certainly not an expert or anything like that. So if you're someone who has seen a lot of his work, it probably jumped off the page even more.
Yeah, because he came through the ring with the same kind of expression, the same kind of intensity, and a lot of the stuff that he did he stays with the black trunks, pure wrestler, some of the same mannerisms and a lot of the same moves. And then like what did it for me was when he went down to sit down to and offered himself up for Zack Sabre Jr. to kick him.
Yeah.
That was like, because I mean, it got to the point where like, it was fine. Like you're kind of aping a little bit the style and coming light, but this kind of hit the spot of the uncanny valley to me, where it stopped being an homage and kind of felt like weird. Like, we're in Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of territory for me. But that's it. I thought it was, overall it was a good match for what it was. The one thing, this was another one I had an issue with, like the booking of the idea, is this was for the New Japan Pro Wrestling World TV Championship, which is a new title. They've said that it's kind of meant mainly for the younger stars. So Zack Sabre Jr. winning it is the equivalent of, say, Jericho winning the AEW Championship at first, to have someone established for younger wrestlers to try to measure themselves up against. Side fact that this is Zack Sabre Jr.'s first singles title in the company. So I like that. But the idea that's supposed to separate, the other thing that's supposed to separate the World TV title is the fact that there's a hard 15-minute time limit. And my issue is that at this point in the show, all matches were like 10 minutes, were around 10 minutes. And then this one, you know, when they did the 10-minute, or I think it was like, you know, like 5 or 10-minute commentary, is like, oh, you know, there's only a 50-minute, and if we hit the time limit, then, you know, that means that, you know, we'll have a second match to figure out who the champion is. But because the match only went for 10 minutes, you didn't have, like, that sprint to the end. You didn't have that drama, which would have helped better establish this title as something else other than the other 90 titles that are in the company, and have, you know, something to really get into it. As a fan growing up, the TV title generally was always my favorite title for that very reason, that it was a hard and fast time limit, and the heels would always, you know, dick around and waste time and, you know, make the clock run out, and they would constantly defeat better wrestlers by basically taking advantage of the time limit, and you would get frustrated and you would hate them. And, you know, and that was kind of the, you know, that was kind of like, you know, added drama to that. And, you know, so it felt disappointing that it just went 10 minutes and didn't really have drama, you know, stretch it out. And as far as, you know, joining TMDK, I think the team does need a charismatic voice with Jonah leaving. And on the following night, they actually broke with tradition, and they actually invited Kosei Fujita to join TMDK as Zack's personal young boy. Fujita helped out Zack Sabre Jr. during his feud with during, you know, his encounters with Evil, where Fujita dressed up as Zack Sabre Jr. so that Evil would attack Fujita thinking it was Zack Sabre Jr., and then this allowed Zack Sabre Jr. to get an easy win on Evil. So thanks to his help, he's actually brought him into TMDK as the Young Lion member, which is usually something you don't see, because these are, you know, trainees, and, you know, they're in the black trunks and supposed to do a limited number of moves. But he brought him in, and he also called out Jon Moxley, because Jon Moxley had sort of done the same thing with Shota Umino when Moxley came in for the G1, and he took Shota Umino as his own personal Young Lion. So I hope this means that there might be something coming up between Zack Sabre Jr. and Moxley down the road.
That'd be really interesting.
On New Year's Dash, some of the matches that teased was TMDK. They got a win on Yoshihashi, so it looks like TMDK is going to be the members, Mikey Nichols and Shane Hayes, are going to be wrestling Bishamon, Yoshihashi, and Goto. And Ishii also staked his claim at the TV Championship.
Yeah, a lot has been set up with these first two shows of the year for New Japan, so that'll be fun to watch progress in the next couple months. Match number 5, Tama Tonga defeating Carl Anderson to win the NEVER Openweight title. I'm not sure that there was a result more obvious than this one with Carl Anderson in WWE. Are you surprised that there wasn't a bigger deal made out of – I mean, it's not exactly – you know, Taz beating Mike Awesome for the ECW title when Taz was a WWF wrestler and Mike Awesome was a WCW wrestler. But, you know, you've got New Japan wrestlers, you've got AEW wrestlers, you've got WWE wrestlers, all on the same card. I mean, these are really the top three promotions in the world sharing a stage in a manner of speaking. Are you surprised that that didn't get more, I don't know, publicity, or are we just in the era of the Forbidden Door? Is it just kind of more commonplace and accepted now?
I think that there might have been edicts from people involved saying, hey, don't really push this if we're going to be on the same card as
I'm talking more about fans. I'm talking more about, you know, the fans who, you know, always seem to mark out for these interpromotional type things. And it's kind of like it was almost a shrug of the shoulders, it seemed like.
Well, I mean, it is Machine Gun Carl Anderson, and he's kind of persona
non
grata.
You've said enough. You've said enough. I totally understand where you're coming from on that.
Yeah. You're talking about pretty much like his only remaining fan, you know? maybe Sage, because I think Sage likes those two guys too. But as a matter of fact, because I was on with Sage and Brian for the watch along, and they did the smart thing and slept through the first half of the show. I did not. So when they asked me like when it has intermission happened yet, there was no intermission of the show. I mentioned, I don't know, right now Tama Tonga and Carl Anderson are on. Do you consider that intermission? So that was kind of like how pretty much felt about the match. Although I liked it from the historical perspective of these are two, and you're right. A lot of this, they could have made a bigger deal on it. These are two original members of the Bullet Club facing each other. Machine Gun Carl Anderson had given Tama Tonga the gun stun as his finisher when Machine Gun Carl Anderson left. So now that the two of them are wrestling each other, it was a battle of Gunstun versus Gunstun, and that's kind of like what led to the finish. I liked the story. I mean, it wasn't a great wrestling match. This is not a high work rate match. I'm pretty sure Anderson is over that if he was ever in that. But overall, I thought they told a good story based on their history. Tama Tonga winning the NEVER title, bringing it back to the U.S. after being held hostage. In the U.S. bringing back to Japan after being held hostage in the U.S. There's been a concerted effort to get Tama Tonga over at this point as probably the lead face of the Hantai side of things in New Japan. So with Tana, you know, it's him and Tanahashi who are the top two, and Tanahashi is obviously on the decline. Unless there's someone I'm missing on that side. You had the essentially like the official passing of the torch from Carl Anderson to Tama Tonga. That I thought was neat from a storyline perspective. I can understand if like wrestling, if that doesn't appeal to you, the wrestling's not going to appeal to you either. And an unfortunate box.
You mentioned that being a... Yeah. You mentioned not a high work rate match. I still thought it was more than Carl Anderson usually does in WWE. So I don't know if that says more about his work rate in WWE.
Yeah, it was more of a brawl though. So it wasn't like doing crazy stuff. It was some stiff spots like on the outside and throwing into the guards and that kind of match. You're closer to Stone Cold kind of just brawl everywhere kind of thing. Which, I mean, works. I mean, it's just
I was going to say, if this is a different generation, that that botched finish, somebody would accuse WWE of telling Anderson to go botch the finish to make New Japan look bad or something like that. I don't know. to make Tama Tonga not
look
as strong or something.
One of the podcasts or something that was on today, somebody kind of mentioned that about was this Carl Anderson being a carny? No, I actually went back. There was one match I had missed, which is this match. The next match, I kind of like, again, I was already at this point like 24 hours or 24, 26 hours up straight by the time of the next match. So I have to go back and watch the Kenji Muda match. I know I saw it, but it just didn't record in my brain. The Carl Anderson one, though, I went back since I wanted to catch the end of that. What it looked like is that when Tama Tonga went for the final gun stun, he launched too hard into Carl Anderson. Carl Anderson did not have the ability. He's already kind of like bent backwards. He couldn't go straight down on the gun stun. So he actually kind of goes down kind of sideways, but too quick. So he actually bumps before Tama goes all the way down. And I think if you would catch it from a different angle, you wouldn't really be able to tell. But it was like probably the worst camera angle you could have gotten, and it looked like Carl Anderson just bumped before he got hit, because he actually slipped out of it, and that's kind of But you could tell that it's because either Carl Anderson was too close to Tama when he launched for the gun stun, or Tama launched too hard and their bodies had collapsed and they were on top of each other. So personally, I think they probably should have just called Mulligan and done another sequence and then, you know, tried it again. But, you know, it is what it is.
Ah, well, Tama Tonga, never open weight champion after that one. Keiji Muto, Tanahashi, and Shota Umino against beat Naito, Sanada, and Bushi in Muto's last New Japan match. So Muto retiring this year. You know, for what he did, he looked okay. I'm not saying he shouldn't be retiring or anything like that. It's not exactly, you know, someone going out on top of their game, but he certainly, I don't think he embarrassed himself out there or anything like that. So that was nice to see. Shota Umino, you know, with the gimmick and everything, it was kind of fun to see, especially when you've watched him, you know, when I was watching the G1s every night and he was in the opening tag matches with the Black Trunks and seeing the young boys kind of graduate from there, seeing him as the second to John Moxley, and now he gets a character all to his own, so that's really cool to see. You know, I'm not a religious follower of Japanese wrestling. I'm aware of the great Muta. I've, you know, WCW and the NWA, and obviously he's a big name in Japan, so you know, it's a big deal, absolutely, to have him on this show and have his retirement as part of the show. I think it was good that New Japan could work that in here on their biggest show of the year. But, you know, you mentioned changing of the guards, and you have Hiroshi Tanahashi and Tetsuya Naito in a, you know, basically a mid-card match. I mean, it was important because it involved Muta, but other than that, it was not necessarily an easy night for them, but it was not a strenuous night based on their previous standards that they set either. So the match, and then, you know, either Muta or, you know, you want to talk about continue that changing of the guards with Naito and Tanahashi here.
Yeah, commentary brought up that team Keiji Muto was the past, present, and future of New Japan. My gut reaction is the fact that they're pushing Shota Umino for big things. He's the one who got the victory in this match over Bushi using the Death Rider.
Yeah.
I believe was it this match where he came out from the crowd? No, he didn't come out from the crowd in this one. New Japan Dash, he came out from the crowd like Moxley did, and they made a big deal about that. This is an exhibition match. I mean, I know it's important because it's Keiji Muto's last match, but it's essentially an exhibition match. And, you know, Tanahashi not being in the singles, not involved in anything the singles-wise. Naito also, and Naito is a very prideful person, and he wrestled with a T-shirt on, which is his I'm at a house show, I can't be bothered with this code. So you had that going on with him. I don't know if LIJ being the main event for night two of Wrestle Kingdom is going to swage him much. But we'll see. Interesting thing was like the Umino getting pushed. He got into it with Naito. It looks like that is a program that they're setting up, Tetsuya Naito versus Shota Umino after Naito is done with whatever he's doing with Kenno from Noah at the part two of Wrestle Kingdom. So that should be interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then we go to Hiromu Takahashi defeating Ishimori, El Desperado, and Master Wato to win the Junior Heavyweight Championship. This is one that the announcers were really pushing, with Takahashi getting the victory in the closing moments of this one as something spectacular. They did a nice job setting up what this meant. Ishimori, the former Junior Heavyweight Champion. You know, another, it goes back to that Junior Tag Title match and, you know, kind of the same pace. And it was a really good match. Ishimori, you know, I'm familiar with from Impact, and so that is fun seeing him here in this and defending his championship. But Takahashi, kind of, you know, of those in this match, seems to be the biggest star in this match. So it makes sense that they want to put the Junior Heavyweight title back on him.
Well, you can make an argument that this was a three match Wrestle Kingdom with this one. Because I just want to read this off real quick. The first match, 10 minutes 30, then 5 minutes 45, 47, 10 minutes 10, 10 minutes 32, 9 minutes 36, 9 minutes 20. This was 16 minutes and 45. So this was a fast show. I mean, for it being as long as it was, the only thing that was long was obviously the Rambo, which is essentially a Royal Rumble that went for 30 minutes. This was your first, like, more meaty show and meaty match, and it was, you know, your fast pace, just, you know, you could see this opening a show, basically. Everybody hitting their moves. One thing I brought up before is that, you know, we've seen how many four-ways. Four-ways aren't really special, for us, because we just roll our eyes thanks to WWE and AEW and AEW hasn't been, they've been a lot better at that, but this is a rarity. This is not something that happens every day in Japan. So this was a more special stipulation. The two stories here was Hiromu, because he's the one who won, and Master Wato. They had Master Wato even going into this as the one that does not belong. They gave him a showcase to show that he can hang out with three people who have been repeated IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champions. So, he was able to hang with these guys. At this point, when you're talking about the New Japan Junior Heavyweight Championship, just flip a coin. I mean, it has to have three heads, but flip a coin and you'll land on Hiromu, Ishimori, or El Desperado. Those are going to be, they're going to be flipping it back and forth. Kushida also involved, because the story going into this was Kushida was supposed to challenge Taiji for the title, but he came down with hand, foot, mouth disease. And then Taiji Ishimori, said that he lost his shot. And then that's when Desperado and Hiromu and Wato came out asking for an opportunity. And he said, screw it, I'll give it to all four of you. So that's what led to this. And he did get pinned, so he has a reason to go after Hiromu. But first, we're going to see Yo come after him. And like I said, Yo, like, pretty had a definitive win. Now, definitive sequence that led to him pinning him at a tag team match.
Yes, the general booking of the four ways of the champion not getting pinned, losing the title, and then asking for a title shot off of that. So standard booking there for the multi-man match, even in New Japan, that we see. The semi-main event, Kenny Omega defeating Will Ospreay for the IWGP United States Championship. This was Omega versus Ospreay. And I liked this because of the story going in. You generally rarely get a feeling that two guys really don't like each other. But what happened on social media, what happened in the build-up to this match, Javier, you really get the sense that Omega and Ospreay don't like each other. And I thought that this added to the story of this match in a way that a lot of matches, even in Japan, you don't have that.
Yeah, a lot of this build was done in AEW programming. There's definitely the idea of Kenny Omega not taking Will Ospreay seriously. They had a great confrontation. I'm glad I saw it before. I saw Wrestle Kingdom at the presser that they did, where, and Kenny Omega, because the story going into this was that when Kenny Omega left, he essentially passed the baton to Will Ospreay, and then he blamed Will Ospreay for the flagging attendance, the fact that there's no cheering crowds, like a good heel, ignoring the fact that there was a pandemic, and then Kenny Omega saying, I'm coming back to, fix what's wrong and show you that, you tried to become me, but you can't, and I'm better. So that was a great storyline heading into this. I seldom give 5 stars to a match. I didn't for this one, because I think this is just the first, if they do this right, this is just the first step. Because with Kenny Omega coming out on top, this is the type of thing that when to cement Will Ospreay at the top, which is, I hope, is the goal, He eventually is going to have to both Will Ospreay has two monkeys on his back, and one of them is Kenny Omega. The other one has been his arch rival, Kazuchika Okada. So this, depending on how things go with Ospreay, I can see this be what that loss be what catapults him in towards a basically having to redeem himself, and likely having to do that through a G1 victory against Okada, and then a rematch with Kenny Omega down the road. So I think this is like the beginning of a story. So, and if they can tell that story, I think this match would definitely rise in the estimation as being the first step.
And then finally, the main event, Kazuchika Okada defeating Jay White for the IWGP World title. Another just excellent, excellent match here between Okada and Jay White. Jay White losing the title here. There's some scuttlebutt that WWE may be interested in Jay White. So just like the Tama Tonga, there's some discussion around that as well. So we've seen WWE dip into the New Japan pool before. But Okada, sort of every time I feel like Okada gets the IWGP title back, it's almost like a reset. It's almost like it's back to like a factory reset, because it's just, you just get so used to Okada being the champion and being the number one guy in the company. And while they're phasing guys like Tanahashi and Naito down a little bit, Okada is still that standard bearer. And it's going to be really weird when he's no longer the top guy anymore for whenever that happens.
Yeah, and the story going into this was a lot like, does Okada have the spirit, the fighting spirit? That kind of was like, which was an interesting like take. It almost feels like they're the last Okada great run, he was untouchable. He was at the top of his game, number one. And that this Okada is not at that same level. So now he actually, before was like, because the Okada in the first run was like, he made things look easy. And now he actually has to try to keep up with the people. That's kind of the gist I got toward the build toward this.
A little bit like John Cena when he was on top. A little bit like John Cena. In his later runs, that was a lot of the storyline focus for his opponents of saying, you've lost a step, you're not what you once were. And that was the story for a couple of his matches toward the end of his full-time run.
Yeah, where he had to find a way to win, not just, that it wasn't just, fait accompli that it was going to happen. He had to, find a way to do it. So that was interesting going into this. And particularly since Jay White has had Okada's numbers, since I think he's Jay White has won more matches that were import against Okada recently. Excuse me. My only like complaint about the match is that we've seen this match a few times already.
Yeah.
So you've got into it real quick, really soon after. The ending kind of feels just like was last year when Jay White lost and he blamed Tomohiro Ishii for being the cause of it. And then because Ishii had beaten him in the G1, and now Jay White's doing the same thing where he's blaming Hikuleo. The Hikuleo's betrayal is what led him to lose the title, setting up at New Year's Dash, he set up a loser leaves town between Jay White and Hikuleo. So that, that scuttlebutt of Jay White maybe going somewhere else, whether that is WWE or maybe just, sticking stateside or going AEW, because the actual stipulation is loser leaves Japan, not necessarily loser leaves New Japan. So they have a little bit of wiggle room. at least how in the promo and what the commentary said. We haven't seen it in paper yet, but that kind of feels like what's going on. This is like rumor of rumors, which I read in passing, that I've heard, and Greg, let me know if you've heard the same thing, that New Japan Strong might be over. And I've heard rumors that, based on the stuff that Tony Khan said, that we'll hear more about ROH after Wrestle Kingdom, that maybe ROH might become like what Strong was, and like AEW, younger AEW talent and the New Japan talent, like, you know, that would be what becomes ROH. And in that case, you know, Jay White being, you know, involved in that as the ROH top guy would kind of make, you know, sense if Jay White were to lose and he has to leave Japan, but, you know, he's still working for New Japan, but he's just working the States.
Yeah, I read that, I think it came from a Tanahashi interview or something like that, and I don't know if I read it today or yesterday, but it was very recently, so really haven't had a chance to see any of the reporting follow-up on that, but that would be intriguing and a change of the landscape in wrestling here in the United States, at least, you know, at that level anyway. So,
I mean, so that was the
New Japan. Yeah.
Well, it's speculation just based on the stuff I've read and trying to put, you know, different Lego pieces together that look like they might fit. But consider the fact that Strong for me has always had kind of the feel of what of RH. They feel like they RH and New Japan Strong kind of feel like they appeal to the same fan base. So that would make sense if the two of them merge into whatever the new RH programming is.
And it would certainly give Tony Khan a selling point for Ring of Honor and the $9.99 cost for Honor Club and to watch these shows. I know there's not a lot of excitement about that when Tony Khan made that announcement, but I think the excitement mm-hmm. would increase if you involve New Japan in that way in it. Night two is January 21st, and that is a joint show with NOAH. So that is coming down the pike later in the month. We also had AEW this past week with their Battle of the Belts show. And, Javier, I just want to briefly touch on AEW here before I run down the card for Impact. It feels like this set of shows this week was another strong one with Rampage, with Battle of the Belts, and even Dynamite. It just feels like AEW is back on a roll of weekly TV and hot crowds. They've had a couple hot crowds, and that's helped. But it does feel like ever since ROH was taken away, that portion of programming was taking out of AEW's hair, that Dynamite, Rampage have improved as a weekly program. Is that just coincidence, do you think, or is it? Was that one of the things that was bogging AEW programming down to this extent to where it just feels so much better without it present?
Honestly, I'm not going to completely sign on to the RH being taken out, being the improvement. I feel they've been focusing more on things, and I've noticed it in the production where they actually do take more than 2 seconds before a match to explain why this match is happening. To build up what you're about to watch, as opposed to bam, go to the next thing, bam, go to the next thing, bam, go to the next thing. So I think that focus maybe is, you know, by removing one ROH mention, it gave them more time to do it, then yes. But I think there's more focus on what's important as opposed to just, you know, booking essentially would be like an independent show of just let's have an awesome card with awesome wrestling and let's not worry about how we got here, B, building up, why is it important, you know, following up on stuff. I feel like they've done a better job in general with that. So I think that might help. And if it's because they don't have to worry about RH and that time they're spending on RH is used for this, then more powerful to them.
Yeah, and I don't know if I even buy that argument myself, because I feel like ever since Full Gear back in November is when you really, after that show and the follow-up to it, that's when it felt like our AEW TV has kind of turned the corner for me. So ROH was still featured at that time, maybe not as heavily, but I mean they had a pay-per-view to plug in December. You know, I don't know that that's the reason, but the timing is interesting, and I thought I would bring it up there, and you know, see, what's the old phrase there? Run it up the flagpole and see if anybody salutes.
I mean, you also, I don't think you've had any major injuries either. You know, that have or, you know, non-reported injuries. You haven't had, you know, people disappear because they said something that angered Tony Khan. You haven't had,
yeah.
you know. So I think it's just that the waters are less choppy, in, you know, and I need to see a bit more before I say, like, it's completely, you know, because, yeah, I mean, you know, Tony Khan defended himself saying, oh, you know, we've been dealing with injuries and we're dealing with that and this and the other. You know, but some of those were self-inflicted, you know, wounds. So, you know, mm-hmm. hopefully now things have been, you know, things continue in the direction they've been going.
Yeah, for sure. And finally, Impact. They have a pay-per-view on Friday night, Hard to Kill, in Atlanta. Rich Swann takes on Steve Macklin in a Falls Count Anywhere match. Joe Hendry against Moose for the Digital Media Championship. Deonna Purrazzo versus Killer Kelly versus Masha Slamovich versus Taylor Wilde in a number one contender match for the Knockouts title. Trey Miguel takes on Black Taurus for the X Division Championship. Motor City Machine Guns versus Heath and Rhino versus the Major Players versus Ace Austin and Chris Bay in a tag title match. Jonathan Gresham takes on Eddie Edwards. Jordan Grace against Mickey James in a title versus career match. And Josh Alexander versus Bully Ray, Full Metal Mayhem for the Impact Championship. I do not know how Excalibur does it. That was... I was going much slower than him, and that was still very hard to fit all that in there. But, Javier, I don't know what your Impact watching is or anything, so I don't know whether to ask you anything about this, but do you have any thoughts on the Impact pay-per-view at all?
Well, just on a couple of matches, I am way behind. I think I'm back still in December in my watching, so I got to get all this watched before Hard to Kill. But the Jordan Grace and Mickey James thing, Mickey James basically a while back cut a promo saying that she's on her last rodeo, that her first loss
yep.
is going to be her, you know, her next loss is going to be her last. She did this after she lost to Chelsea Green, who was her friend and betrayed her, and they had a match until the Green won. She went home, thought things over, came back, and then, you know, and so she's been defeating everybody who's faced her. And now going after the championship against Grace in what I would have to assume is going to be her last match. I do not think that she wins the championship. I think this is why I'm tuning in. Although Hard to Kill is not one of their big pay-per-views. That's one of their plus shows, right?
It said pay-per-view on Wikipedia, so I'm going to assume it's a pay-per-view until I hear otherwise. I'll have to see on TV this week how they frame it, because it is always very confusing to me whether shows are pay-per-views or their Impact Plus special events. I feel like Hard to Kill has been a pay-per-view lately.
Yeah, I mean, considering the fact that the main event is Josh Alexander, Billy Ray, that's the story they've been building to. That's why I don't. It's weird. since it's a pay per view, I don't think Mickey James would win. If it's a plus, then maybe she wins and then loses at a pay per view. But if Hard to Kill is one of their big whatever four whatever number that they have, then yeah, I think this is Mickey James's retirement. Josh Alexander and Bully Ray is another one. Story going into this was Bully Ray says that he won the what do they call it? A gauntlet match
at Bound for Glory.
Yeah, Call Your Shot. There we go. Call Your Shot Championship. So, which is essentially their version of Money in the Bank. He said that he's going to do this the right way. He called the shot for one. He's going to have the match. He's not going to do a run in, and that he's a good guy. He's trying to convince everybody he's a good guy. And then, nope, Bully Ray is Bully Ray, and he's been terrorizing Impact since. Leading to the match with Josh Alexander and Bully Ray. I haven't seen much of it, but, you know, enough to know what that's going on. Trey Miguel ended up turning heel and is now wrestling Black Taurus for the X Division Championship. Death Dolls, which would be Jessica and mainly Taya Valkyrie, Rosemary's been the odd woman out for the most part, because it used to be Rosemary and Taya Valkyrie, but Jessica got a new after being. Did she get killed, or did she? No, she didn't get killed after losing to.
Kind of strange that we even have to ask that question, though, isn't it?
after losing to Masha Slamovich in in emphatic fashion. She went into, she returned to the Undead Realm, where she was recovered for something happened, and she came back more as a party girl than, you know, the kaiju queen. So she's kind of like a fun-loving person. Rosemary kind of feels like the odd woman out. So Jessica and Ty Valkyrie became the Death Dolls. So that's what's going on with that. Some people are just rolling their eyes right now. And they're going up against the team of Giselle Shaw, Savannah Evans, and Tasha Steeles with Jai Vidal. So apparently there's more going on there than I'm actually familiar with. Got to catch up on that. But, you know, they've basically been doing this for like a couple months now. Is there anything else I recognize from here? I don't know how we got to Joe Henry versus Moose, but anytime you see Joe Henry is probably my my biggest. Oh man, what's the term? Oh man, I'm getting too old and being forgetful. I love Joe Henry. Just guilty pleasure. That was the word.
I was really
guilty
trying to
pleasure.
Help you out, but you didn't give me enough there to even guess.
It was guilty pleasure. I mean, I had to take
there
my mind
you
off
go.
Before he could pop in. My I think he made me possibly in wrestling my biggest guilty pleasure is Joe Henry. So.
Oh yes,
and,
I've on this show professed my love for his cheesy vignettes that reintroduced him recently.
Well, and dude, he's a good wrestler.
Yeah,
he's a style of wrestler I really like. You know.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, yeah. And then, oh, yeah, Richard Sloan versus Macklin. Macklin just, you know, hates people. That's
I can relate.
Where we are. That.
I think we can all relate.
Yeah, and you know, yeah. There's the multi-man tag team match. I, you know, probably got there because of too many tag teams and there wasn't much time to do a storyline there. Good to see you, Yuramura, getting on the card in the pre-show. With Kushida. Kushida's on there too. Mike Bailey, Mike Jackson, Boo Pinder Gujar, and Angels. I'm assuming that's Alan Angels.
Oh yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so should be
yeah,
a you know, should be a I mean, this looks like it's a full pay per view, so I'm gonna go ahead and call that a full pay per view.
Okay, let's do it. Let's call it a pay-per-view. The hard-to-kill pay-per-view will be on Friday night, and we'll have coverage of it next Sunday here on Wrestling Night in America, so tune in then. Javier, it's been a lot of fun having you on, talk New Japan, and walking us through the storylines here. Really appreciate you coming on tonight. And before you go, as we usually do, let people know where they can find you on social media and when they can find your work for The Torch.
Yeah, I generally write the primers. It's getting late. I generally write the primers. I'm on usually a lot on the after shows for AEW and WWE. Pitch in with New Japan here and there. New Japan Pride Podcast. I just don't have too much time to really get into it and mainly to keep up with all the New Japan shows. So that's why that's kind of languished, but I do it for like the big, you know, for the G1 especially, because I will take an entire month off of work to just for the G1. but yeah, and social media, I'm somewhere. I think I'm J Machado LK, I think, at J Machado LK. I don't ever tweet, so follow me if you want to, you know, not have, you know, and I'll follow you back. So, but I won't bother you. I promise.
That's a really soft sell on the social media. Not the usual hard
yeah.
sell.
I mean, at some point, I may, you know, there've been moments where I'm like, no, let me not, you know. So there's some people that, you know, sometimes some people make an assumption about something and it's like, you know, no, that's not what you're doing. But you know, I try not to get involved. I just mainly use it to follow, like, you know, what's going on in wrestling and pretty much it. So.
That's the best way to do it. Don't take it too seriously. That's kind of how I live on social media.
Do you remember when Twitter first started, what was the number one rule on Twitter that's been completely forgotten? And I hope, you know, someone decides, you know, we make a big deal about it, we'll bring it back. Do you remember what the number one rule was?
I don't.
Don't feed the trolls.
Yeah. Well, that's a rule anywhere you go. I mean,
a lot of Twitter drama is always someone responding to someone who obviously is writing something to get a rise out of you. Don't respond to that person.
It's the basis of how I live my life on social media and outside. Don't feed the trolls. So that is a very good sentiment to end the show on here, Javier. Luckily, we don't have to worry about trolls here on Wrestling Night in America. Thanks again for joining me here tonight. We'll have you on again soon.
All right. Have a good night.
Absolutely. And I hope everyone else has a good night. Tune in next Sunday night when we'll be here talking about the big shows in pro wrestling once again, because if it's Sunday, it is Wrestling Night in America.